We are holding on mem bays on the bays, 5 lines from the end of the narrow lines. Okay. Still talking about Tam, still talking about a sure that Gore is a person, Tam or Moore, as the case may be. So yesterday we discussed when the puzzle to the Bala show Noki, what were the various things that last couple of days, we learned the various things that we learned from that. Now we're going to back to earlier in the puzzle. When the Torah starts describing the case, the Torah says that the Torah in two back-to-back psukim mentions the case where the shur kills a man or a woman. Turn around on a behemoth isha isha. When the pasuk says by a muad that if the shur muad kills a man or a woman, then the same rules apply. There's the chiyuv misa for the animal and a chiyuv kofer for the owner. What are those words? Behemoth isha isha coming to teach us? Im l'chayev ala isha ki isha. You're going to tell us that just it's coming to tell you. You wouldn't know otherwise. You would think maybe there's only misa and kofer in the case where gored a man, not a woman. Can't. The previous pasuk already says mentioned that if it gores a man or a woman, and there's no logical reason to think that there should be a difference between tam and muad in that regard, especially because we learned in the first parak that abedaba from the words vehemis isha isha, we learn that when it comes to dine oinshin and dine mominus and so forth, men and women are equal in halacha, so there'd be no reason to distinguish. Ela lahakish isha laish. No, rather, Rabbi Akiva says it comes to make a hekish between a man and a woman. Ma ish nizak of the yoke. One of them is coming to teach us that hishvakos of isha laish, that in general there's an equation for all dini nizikin between men and women. The other one is telling us specifically that when it comes to the who inherits the nizikin, the same rules apply to men and to women. Ma ish nizak of the yoke. So just like with a man, If a man gets killed by a shur, he himself is dead. So who gets the kofer? Who gets the kofer payment? His heirs. As ishan is a keil liyosheha. The same way, then, if a woman gets killed, you don't say then that her husband gets the kofer or whatever other payments there are to be paid. No, it goes to her, and therefore, since she's dead, then it goes to her yoshin, her children from another marriage, or not her husband. Her father's family, etc. Yeah. That's what we learned from that, Rabbi Akiva says. Okay, the question is, so what are you telling me that Rabbi Akiva holds that the nizikin of a woman are not inherited by her husband? But we learned in a braisa, the yora shoisa, when the pasuk describes the dinim of Yerusha in Parshas Pinchas coming up soon. The pasuk says the yorash osa that literally the yorash osa means he inherits her.
What is that?
Well, the pasuk is describing if a person dies and has no sons, then his daughters inherit, and if he doesn't have sons or daughters or descendants thereof, then his brothers inherit, and so forth. It keeps on recursively going up. And then the pasuk says that you give it l'she'eroi hakorev elok to his nearest relative, the yorash osa, and he inherits it. Rabbi Akiva explains Pasuk to be saying, and the Gemara has a long discussion about this in Brava Basra with a couple of different other possibilities, how we learn it exactly, that another meaning of it is v'yorash oisa, that she'eroi then means his wife, because she'eroi means the one who's close to him, which is his wife. But it doesn't mean, now, that would make it sound like she yashim him. No, Rabbi Akiva explains that it means, okay, the yorash oisa, when there's anything that belongs to she'eroi, namely to his wife, the yorash oisa, he inherits it. Again, the Gemara there in Baba Basra, he meaning the husband.
So it contradicts.
So Rabbi Akiva is saying that a husband does inherit from his wife, divir Rabbi Akiva, so then why should it be any different by Nizaki? Okay, the Rashba points out that Pekeh, the Gemara could have said that's the point. Because you have a statement that a Baal Yod is a Shishtai normally, therefore maybe here the Torah is making an exception and saying not Nazaki. However, the Gemara is going to answer differently. Omer Eshlokish, Loi Omer Elba Kofer. Yes, but you know what? Rabbi Akiva is not talking about Nizikin in general. True, Nizikin in general become part of her estate, and therefore her husband would inherit them, just like any other property of hers. He is talking about only specifically by kofer. Because when he said Nizak of Yoshev, he mentioned Nizakin, but he meant specifically kofer. Well, we're going to continue discussing that soon. We're going to see whether maybe that stands in the end. But wait, we'll see. So he's only talking about kofa. Hoyova in mishtalam el la'acham misa. Because, by definition, kofa is only paid after she dies, unlike Nizakin, where Shur or any of the other obvious Nizakin injures her. She might survive it. She might live. She might live for many years afterwards, and the money gets paid while she's still alive. So sure, when eventually she dies, then yeah, it goes to her husband like everything else. But here, kofa by definition is only paid if the shur killed her. Therefore, it only comes into play after she's dead. But how do they
usually
not usually by definition? By definition, okay. So the Maharam Shif talks about the Gemara is gonna discuss what the difference is between that and the Misa of the Shur. The Maharam Shif explains you could logically make a distinction. You could say worst comes to worst. Okay, if Kofa mistakenly got paid while she was still alive and she ended up surviving it, fine, it could be reimbursed. As opposed to when it comes to killing the Shur, the Gemara is gonna take it as a given that killing the Shur is only done when she dies, because if you give skila to the Shur, and then it turns out that she survives her injuries after all, you can't bring the Shur back alive. So therefore, the Gemara in a minute is going to take it as a given that the skila of the Shur only takes place once the victim is dying. But the Gemara is going to explain, based on an Ekish in the Pasuk, that the same thing applies to Kofa. So even though it is true, in principle, you could, Basin could tell the guy to pay Kofa, and if she ends up surviving, you'll get it back. But they don't. So therefore, this is the kind of estate, this is the kind of Yerusha which is called Roy. Namely, it's not in her possession right now. There's Roy versus Muchtek. We talked about it in Ksuba. Muchtek is something that the testator, the one who passed away, has in their possession now. Roy is something that's destined to come into their possession. Now, later on, we're going to talk a little further in the sugya that when it comes to the dinim of Bechor, for example, when it comes to the dinim that a Bechor inherits a double portion, there the Torah distinguishes between Roy and Mukhtar, that a Bechor does not get a double portion of Roy. By the same logic, the Einabal, note of a Roy to a Mukhtar, by the same logic, the same dinim would apply then, even if we're saying that Rabbi Akiva is saying in a Torah, a husband yashins his wife, which again is not uncontroversial. The Gemara discusses it a lot in Bava Basra. But anyway, the point is, even appointed by Kibbutz, that it is Daraisa, there would still be that distinction. The husband only inherits what's Mosek, not what's Roy. Kofa, by definition, is only going to be Roy. So then her children, for example, from her children from her previous marriage, or if she doesn't have any children, then her father's family, etc., would inherit what's Roy. Right?
Only
Mosek would go to the husband. Right? So my timer. So what's the reason? Why taka do you only pay kofa after the person has died? Omakra, because the pasuk says, "Behemis isha isha," that if the shur killed a man or a woman, I show you suck of a gambal of yumas. The shur gets skila. The owner is also chayiv misa, meaning again misa b'dichmayim. Im kofa yushas olav, and then the pasuk continues, if kofa is imposed on him, then he has to pay the kofa. Implying that the Torah is making a hekish. When do you pay kofer? Only when the shur is going to get skila. And for the shur
to get skila?
Only when the shur, yeah. Okay, we're going to have a discussion soon, actually. We're going to have the opinion of Rava that the two of them are, in fact, interdependent. That only when the shur is actually going to get skila, that only when the shur is liable for skila and actually gets skila, is kofer going to be paid. If you have a scenario where the shur is not going to get skila, then no kofer is going to be paid. We'll discuss that. But for right now, what we're saying is, leaving that aside, the point is kofer only exists after the shur at a point when the shur would have gotten skila. That is the point when kofer comes into play. And of course, the shur is not going to get skila until the victim is actually dead. Again, because like the Maharam Shif says, you can't do it ahead of time just in case, because you can't bring it back alive. It turns out that the person survived. Therefore, by the same logic, kofer is only meant to be paid after the person dies. Therefore, even if you were to, by mistake, pay kofer while she's still alive, you would still consider it roi rather than bokseh. And the husband, therefore, and that's the point. Rabbi Akiva would say, therefore, that's why the pasuk is telling us that the husband doesn't inherit. Tosfos points out, then in that case, the Gemara should have asked the other way around. Okay, if we know the husband never inherits from Roy, then why do we need a special limud when it comes to kofer, given that kofer is by definition Roy? Tosfos says, okay, but you could argue maybe true roi is something that only the circumstances come about after she dies. Here you have the actual circumstances that lead to the kofar happen while she was alive. She was good. So maybe you would think that's not considered total roi, and therefore the pasuk has to tell us that it is. Okay. The question then is, Nizakin le'omer Rav Akiva, fine, but you're telling me that Rav Akiva would not say when it comes to other Nizakin that the woman herself gets, that the Rav Akiva, again, Rav Akiva had said generically, Nizak of Le'yosha. So like you said a couple of minutes ago. So Rosh Lakish is trying to say that maybe he means only that after she Nizakei Le'yosha. So Rosh Lakish was saying that Rav Akiva is limiting that only to Kofar, but when it comes to any other Nizakin, she will inherit it. She will get it, and therefore her heirs, her father's family will inherit it. So you're telling me that that's what Rabbi Akiva holds? Well, Tanya, but we learned it in Braisa. Hika is the issue of Yotze Yolodeha. If a man, if a person hits a woman and she miscarries, as we talked about yesterday, the primary discussion of it, by the way, is going to be in the next parak in a few days. Noisen nezek v'tzal isha, so you pay nezek and tzar to the woman, udmei v'lod, this labal, and you pay the value of the v'lod, it's the difference in her value between when she's pregnant and when she's not, to the husband. Tosfos points out, what about, as mentioned, nezek and tzar, what about ripui and shevet? So boshes, okay, you have to have the right to be tough on. What about ripui and shevet? So Tosfos argues that normally in a case like that, she won't necessarily need ripui. She miscarried. She won't necessarily need afterwards. Depends how far along she was, I guess, but not necessarily will there be ripui involved. And shevet also, okay. I mean, she would have lost time off work when she actually had the children as well. So like this, when she miscarried them, there's no real extra shevet. That's how Tosfos learns. But there are other Rishonim who learn other possibilities that maybe the Gemara is not mentioning. So there's different other possibilities that Mephoshim talk about. Maybe Ripui actually would go to the husband because one of the husband's responsibilities is to pay for his wife's doctor bills, as we learned from Silvis. Okay, anyway. So you pay the Nezik and Tzar to the woman, the Vlodot to the husband. Ein Habal, if there is no husband, meaning that he died, Noisim Yosha, then the whatever was supposed to go to him, the Dmei Vlodis, goes to his Yosha. Ein Ha'isha, if there's no woman, meaning that she died, she didn't die directly from the blow. That would be what we discussed yesterday, whether you apply from the Dabamane or not. We're talking about she survived it, and then later, before you had a chance to go to Beis Din and get the case adjudicated, she died.
From another cause, yeah.
Noisim Yosha, so then the money is paid to her Yosha. Continues the Blight. The Ha'isha Shivcha B'Nishtakara, suppose that this woman was a shifcha, and she was freed, which Rashi learns means that she was already freed. She was already a freed slave woman before she ever became pregnant, and then she became pregnant from a ger and ever mishulver. We know that a ger or an ever the shifcha mishufreres are not considered their birth family is not considered their family anymore la halacha because gerushin is guy caught in shenerlod and an ever b'chala no yichud. So if she and her husband, let's say her husband is also a ger or an ever mishufre, which okay it doesn't have to be, but usually that would be the case that people tend to marry among their own groups. If they both die, then there's nobody to yash them. As we learned in Kedushin, for example, their nechasim are available for the taking. They're hefter.
The children won't get it.
If they have children, but we're talking about if they have no children. If they have no children, then their birth family is dead.
Anyone without
No, because a regular born yid always has relatives. You keep on going back recursively up the family tree. You can go all the way back to the progenitor of the Shevet if you have to. You can go all the way back to the guy from Shevet Reuben. You could wind up going all the way back to Reuben and then back down to find
him.
You do, that's the point. You do go laterally. You start with, it works briefly like this. I mean, we'll learn the details in Brother Baxter, but it's an example of recursion. You start with looking, does he have any sons? If he doesn't have any living sons, does he have any descendants from his sons? No, does he have any living daughters? No, does he have any living descendants from his daughters? No, go back up one generation. He had a father, of course. Does his father have any other living sons? Or any other living descendants of those sons? Yes, then it goes to them. No, does he have any daughters or descendants of those daughters? Yes, goes to them. If not, go back up another generation. And you keep on going up generation after generation. Yes, eventually you're going to find something. So anyway, so
then, in the Holocaust, what did they do?
Okay, nowadays nobody knows what Shevet they're from for the most part, but in principle, in principle, you can go back. You can go back generation after generation and then descend back down and eventually find. Nowadays, not everybody knows their yichus more than a couple of generations back. So practically speaking, you may not be able to find, but that doesn't necessarily make that it doesn't necessarily make that it's hefker. As opposed to, again, with a ger, where by definition, if he has no children, it's hefker. So anyway, so Rashi learns, and Tosfos also starts learning, that that's the case we're talking about, that she became pregnant after she was already freed. Tosfos then brings from the Riva, who learns differently, who wants to say that it's talking about when she became pregnant while she was still a slave. And now, after injury, she was freed. Okay, anyway. So, oi giyoris, or if she was a giyoris, again, where she's pregnant from a ger, so both of them died, and now, again, neither of them have any heirs, zocha, then the person who caused the injury, who made her miscarry, is zocha, meaning because there's nobody to give it to. He gets to keep. He gets to keep this amount that he would have paid. If he made lobbies, he gets to keep it because there's nobody to give it to.
Why can't you give it to Hekdesh? Why can't you give it to Hekdesh?
If he wants to give it to Hekdesh, he gives it to Hekdesh. There's no Hekdesh has no particular more claim on it than anybody else. Just like, in other words, the same thing as leaving aside this guy who hit her. Once the ger and giyoris die, they're nechosim are free for the taking. Yeah, they have no descendants. They're nechosim are free for the taking creditors. Well, this guy had nechosim in his possession, which was supposed to belong to them. Therefore, he's the first claimant on it. He winds up being zocher, and it's from Hefker.
Kill someone and he's
okay, there's always corner cases like that. But all it is he doesn't end up having to pay it. Okay. Anyway, the point is that the Braisa mentioned that if the woman's dead, then you give it to her yorshim, if there are yorshim. So you see that Rabbi Akiva is saying more generally that nezakim of a woman go to her yorshim. What are you trying to limit it only to kosher? Amri, so Omarabba Begrusha. The Braisa can clearly say who it's according to, but Rabbi Akiva is the only one who's discussing this concept of who the nezakim go to. Therefore, we would assume this Braisa is according to Rabbi Akiva. Omarabba Begrusha. So Rabbi says, the case of the Braisa is talking about where she's divorced. Namely, Rashi explains that her husband divorced her at some point after the injury, after the miscarriage, before the collection was done. Therefore she gets it. Therefore, it goes to her, and if she's dead, it goes to her Yoshim. V'chein omer Rav Nachman begrusha. However, they ask on that, the Yeshivalite, the Bnei HaYeshiva, the Amoraim, ask, Grusha nami tiflik bin mei blodis. Okay, but even so, Grusha, shouldn't she be sharing in the dmei blodis? When we say over here sharing, the way that Rashi is learning, Rashi doesn't spell it out clearly, but Mefarshim explained that Rashi mentioned the case where she was divorced after the injury in order to imply, well, at the time of the injury, at the time of the miscarriage, she was still married. Bechura, then the husband had a certain claim on this dmei blodis now. He had a claim on all of it, actually, like we said before. Fine, they're divorced. We're not going to say he should get all of it, but at least it should be split 50-50. There are other Rishonim who learn differently, that the case of Grusha could be that she was divorced before the injury ever happened, before the miscarriage ever happened. She became pregnant while she was married, of course, but then sometime before the blow, she was divorced. And then when the Gemara says Tifloy, doesn't mean to divide per se, it just means she should be getting all of it.
Okay.
It's just two different ways of learning the word Tifloy. Usually Tifloy means to split it. So Rashi took the word tiflug at face value, therefore we have to explain that she was married at the time of the blow. The other Rishonim say it doesn't have to be that way necessarily, and tiflug can be meant in a more general sense.
The blood belongs after the divorce, the blood pregnant still belongs to the husband?
No, according to Rashi, at the time of the injury, at the time of the miscarriage, she was still married. Therefore her husband was entitled to dmei blodis, the whole thing. Fine, now she's divorced. Maybe he shouldn't be entitled to 100% of it, but he should be entitled to 50%, and that's what the Gemara means by tiflay.
The
other way of looking at it is, if it means that she was divorced before the injury ever happened, then, of course, she should be zoche in 100% of it. The husband shouldn't have lechora any claim on it. And then tiflay does not mean to split it. It means she should get the whole thing. Then tiflay is not meant in a precise sense of
exactly.
It doesn't just mean for a tizker. There are Rishonim will give a gears to tishker, that she should take it. Okay. Anyway, So back to the question then. If you're saying that it's talking about a grusha, okay. So according to Rashi, the husband is still entitled to some part of it. What are you saying that it all goes to Ruyoshim? Amar Papa, Hatoda Zichzit, Mev Lodis, Sabal, Afila Baalei Abuznus. You should know something, Rav Papa says. You're assuming that it actually depends on whether she's still married or not? No. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even matter whether they ever were married at all. Even if the husband was, even if the man, he wasn't a husband, they were never married. They were mezanet together, and she became pregnant. Nevertheless, the Torah is mezakeh the dmei v'lodis to the husband. My time, omakra kasha yoshis ala baal ha'isha, because the pasuk says according to the amount that the baal of the woman will impose that. Wait, baal Rashi says is meloshin aboyala kafir. That is meloshin boil that he had relations. No, because Meforshim say if it meant dafka her husband, it wouldn't have said Baal Aisha, it would have said Bailah. Bailah, her husband. Okay. The fact that it says Baal Aisha comes to teach us, as long as he had relations with her, as long as the as includes even a boil, then he's entitled to Dmei Boil. It could have, but it says Baal Aisha, implying the one who had relations with the woman. Well, Tosfos does point out one thing, that based on the Yerushalmi, the reason why the Torah didn't just use the word boil is because there is a distinction. It has to be somebody who Kiddushin would be toifus with her if they had wanted to. Therefore, the Yerushalmi gives an example. Suppose a man was mezane with his mother or his sister and she became pregnant, then we would not say that he's entitled to marry mother. Then he's not considered a baal, then he's not, right, then he's only a boil. He has no possibility of becoming a baal because Kiddushin are not toifus, then he's not entitled to marry mother. So that's why the Torah has to use the word baal rather than boil. But nevertheless, it's about the Yerushalmi Tosfos. But nevertheless, that is why the Torah, that's why, on the other hand, the Torah could have said by law, which would mean her actual lawfully wedded husband. No, Baal Ha'isha means just that he had relations with her. Anyway, so therefore, so no, there's no difference between a Grusha or not. Regardless whether she was ever married to this guy or not, he's still entitled to Dmei Vlodis. Well, that, nobody's disagreeing with her papa at this point. That seems to be the maskana. The bottom line, therefore, is if we say that, then we're back to what we said before. When Rabbi Akiva says nizakeha liyosheha, he cannot mean mevlodis because those go to the husband no matter or the man no matter or the father of the children no matter what. Therefore, it has to be like the Shlokish said that Rabbi Akiva was only talking about toivah. Okay, the question is, no, well, we're going to, well, at this point, right. However, the Gemara asks, why did Rabbah and Rav Nachman find a need, going back to their opinion, why did they find a need to say that the case was talking about a grusha? This concept that we have of Roy versus Muchzuk, Rabbah and Rav Nachman themselves have a machlokes on the subject in Bava Basra when an outstanding debt is considered roi and when it's considered muchzak. Namely, benoitma l'Rabbah, so let Rabbah himself explain the case that it's talking about. Noitma means he should shtel it out, meloshen ukimta. He should shtel out in the case that, for example, if Beis Din collected money to pay the nezek and sar and so forth, which Rabbah would hold, as we're going to say in a second, that ma'os, that money is not considered muhsak, it's considered roi. Well, Rav Nachman could venture gobble kauka, and according to Rav Nachman, say the other way around, that Beis Din made the guy pay kauka, where Rav Nachman holds fakir, that kauka is considered roi, and money is considered muhsak. To Amar Rabbah, as in
so
fact,
what are we saying?
We're saying, what did we said at the top of the Amud, we said Rabbah and Rav Nachman said, you know how you have a case where the woman herself is going to be entitled to the Dmei Vlodis rather than the husband getting them is going to be where she's divorced, and then therefore she gets to keep it, and that's a case where it doesn't go to the husband. Instead, why don't they say, look, given the distinction that we made before between Roy and Muchzak, the husband only inherits Muchzak from his wife, not Roy. Each of them is able to find a case, according to their respective shittas, where the payment of a debt that was only done after she died is considered roi rather than muhsak. Therefore, you don't have to say she's divorced. You could say she's happily married, but then she dies, and the payment is done in one or the other of these ways, as Rabbah and Rav Nachman's respective opinions in Bava Basra, but it's still considered roi, and the husband wouldn't inherit it. Why don't they do that? Namely, the Amar Rabbah, that Rabbah says in a case in Bava Basra, the case over there actually is, the case over there in Bava Basra is, again, it is involving a Bechur, whether a Bechur inherits a double portion of certain property. basically, the case is that they're arguing about a case. If you have their father left them their father left them property. Okay. Suppose you have a case where their father had lent somebody money. Their father had lent somebody money, and the guy only paid it back after their father died. Is that considered roi or mukhsar? So there's two ways of looking at it. That if they collected karka from the guy, then that is considered mukhsar, and therefore the bechor gets a double portion of it.
Change for the money.
Yeah, the father had lent the guy $100. Now they wind up collecting karka in payment of the debt. Rabbi would say that because you're collecting karka, that makes it considered. So this karka was not in their father's possession when he died. They only took it in payment of the debt afterwards. However, so Rabbi would say that is not considered roi. That's considered mukhsar because he had a shibur on this karka while he was still alive. Therefore, in that sense, it's mukhsar to him. Gavum mois ein roi. Whereas if they collected money in payment of the debt, that's considered roi. And then the bechor doesn't get a double portion of it because that's not mois that were in their father's possession when he died.
That's
only a single portion of it, just like everybody else. The bechor only gets mukhsar, not from right. Doesn't get a double portion from right. Rav Nachman over gavu mois yeshle gavu karka ein loy. And Rav Nachman says the other way around: if they collected money in payment of the debt, then that is considered mukhsar because he lent out money and now he's getting back money. And now they are getting back money in payment of the debt. But gavu karka ein loy. But if they collect karka, that is considered roi. That's not considered mukhsar. Because okay, he had a shibur on, very nice, but that karka didn't belong to him at the time. So again, back to our case over here. You could have then that the woman was injured and miscarried, etc. Later on, she died. Eventually, afterwards, the guy paid the dmei v'lodes in money or in karka, as the case may be, and Rabbah and Rav Nachman could very well be arguing whether that's roi or mukhsar, and therefore whether the husband will inherit it or not. Why don't they just do that instead of talking about a case of a grusha? The answer is, Amri, they answered, Hani mila l'bnei ma'arov al libe d'rabbanan. Yes, but all of that is only true according to what the bnei ma'arov, the chachamim from Eretz Yisrael, sent a message to Bavel saying that they hold like the Rabbanan and Rebbe have a machloikus over there in Bava Basra in a case that's called Shovchu Nechosam Lacham Mises Avihem. Suppose they inherited property from their father. Later on, before they had a chance to divide the estate, the value of the property went up. Does the Bechor get a double portion of that increase in value? So the Rabbanan hold that not, Rebbe holds that yes. So the Bnei Ma'arov al libe d'Rabbanan, then yeah, you can have this discussion about the payment of the milvah, whether it can be considered roi or mukhsar. But over here, Rabbah and Rav Nachman are talking about within Rebbe's opinion, that there is no distinction in that. Regardless, the Bechor would definitely get a portion of the Shvach. Therefore, for sure, he gets a double portion of the payment of the Chayv, whether it was done in money or in karka. Therefore, they can't use that reasoning over here, and they have to say, therefore, that's talking about a grusha.
Because
there's no other way to do it. There's no other way to find a case where the husband wouldn't be getting these maid laws.
If the value of the land or the value of whatever inheritance goes up,
that's the point. That's the machlokes of Rebbe and the Chachamim, whether Rebbe and the Rabbanan. Whether Rebbe says that you do get a double portion of it, regardless, and the Chachamim say that not. So therefore, when it comes to a loan being paid back, Rebbe would say it doesn't matter whether it was paid in loan, whether it was paid in money or in karka. Either way, the bechor is going to get a double portion of it. Applying that to the case of a husband and wife, either way, the husband is going to inherit it from the wife. Therefore, you can't use that to say that that's a case where the husband won't get the maid
love. And the Chachamim say no.
The Chachamim say no, fine, but there's...